refer to your sermon notes or to the screen behind us or to your Bible for our message reference this morning, Luke chapter 24, and I'll just read verses 13 through 26. Now that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. May the Lord add his blessings to the reading of his word this morning. You may be seated. Let's see, I think I have a little bit of catching up to do. Last week it was, if that doesn't light your fire, then your wood is wet. Okay. And then today it was, if that doesn't stir you, your spoon done fell out of your bowl. Those are pathetic. Not really. I'm going to add those to my dictionary from Crooked Creek Assembly of God in Cut Off, Arkansas. Well, Luke chapter 24 is considered by many people who study the Word and study Scripture to be an exceptional chapter in many, many different ways, especially in literary value and in beauty, writing beauty. And it's often seen as one of the very best examples of Luke's writing skills. Tucked right in the middle of it is this narrative, this story, which is referred to most commonly as the Emmaus Road experience. It also is very special as well as very intriguing. I like the words of John Davies as were quoted at the top of your note sheet today. When Christ appeared to Mary Magdalene in the garden, it was intimate. He called her by name. When Christ appeared to the disciples and later to Thomas behind closed doors, it was powerful. He gave them the Holy Spirit and strengthened their faith. When Christ appeared on the shores of Lake Galilee, cooking fish for the disciples' breakfast, it was mysterious and solemn and special. And to Cleopas and his companion in their lodgings at Emmaus, it was all of those things: intimate, empowering, mysterious, solemn, and yes, special. In order for you and I to grasp the real significance of this story, we need to try to move ourselves back in time, actually, as best we can and see reality from that time frame. We have the advantage today, of course, of all of this after-the-fact knowledge, Paul Harvey's The Rest of the Story, if you'd like, the testimony of the written word, and some 2,000 years of follow-up time to unpack the meaning of everything that took place during those three significant days of the age of Cleopas and his companion. Neither them nor any of the other followers of Jesus had our advantage point. So we need to try to understand those events and how they reacted to them and how they responded to them in the real time of their day in history. So in this moment, we're on the road to Emmaus. The unthinkable horror, I suppose, of all that happened surrounding Jesus. His arrest, his trial, the scourging, and the crucifixion. All of those things are now history. His followers are in the process of either scattering or hiding somewhere in the aftermath of all of that. And of course, they are full of questions and full of fear. It's very evident as we read through this story that everybody we meet, every character in this story and those around it, are in the throes of that difficult task of processing what has taken place and how it changes everything for them. Isn't it true? The more dramatic the change that comes in our life, the more complex dealing with it and working through it seems to be. The more sudden or negative that change is, the more struggle is involved in coming to grips with it. Most of us in our family or our acquaintances have had some issue of the sudden awareness of a death in among our loved ones, and sometimes that is brutal and sudden and too young, and we just struggle working our way through that and coming to grips with it. Others, it's a diagnosis sometimes, and it is life-changing. We recognize that up front, but what does it mean and what does it entail? And it launches an incredible and sometimes very painful, difficult process of working our way through it. Well, it's very evident in this account that we are watching and listening as the followers of Jesus make their own effort of processing change. We have the advantage of Luke's skillful pen used by the Spirit of God, so we can walk along with Cleopas and his companion as they work through this process. People skilled in the role of grief counseling and other things, people who counsel and work with individuals or families or larger groups even, processing difficult change, have often taken advantage of the capacity to enumerate a series of steps or phases or stages as generally explaining what occurs as we work to process dynamic or traumatic change. None of these lists seem to ever be presented as either universal or dogmatic necessarily, but more they seem to be used as indicators or markers of what normally happens when we are placed in such change environments as to call it dramatic or traumatic. Processing change of this nature begins with what is the status quo in our life, how things are defined before change ensues and we know it's on its way. Then what has arrived? That speaks of the new events and the new information, foreign elements, if you would, which impact the status quo of our life and threaten to change it. The big question of what's going to happen now is sometimes referred to as the chaos stage of processing change. We are filled with fear and uncertainty and questions and anxiety and dread may overwhelm us and our emotions may in fact run wild. Ultimately, change processors arrive to the question, what do we do with this? What to do with it? Referred to by some as the practice stage. It's also often referred to as the first stage of integration, coming to grips with the change, becoming familiar with the new circumstances, learning to use them and the dynamics of that changed situation on our status quo. And finally, there is the reality of what is now, or the new status quo. Change has come. It may be irreversible. It may be immovable. And simply stated, this is the stage of accepting a new reality in our life and moving on. Well, Cleopas and company, not only his companion, but everyone else around the scene unfolding during that three-day period, they are clearly in the throes of a similar process. They're trying to understand and place in perspective and read the impact of all that had occurred in just around 72 hours of time, and yet which seemed to change their lives so profoundly, so irreversibly, and forever. Now remember, they don't have the record of written scripture. They don't have 2,000 years of unpacking time. They are living these events in the very moment. Let's note the last phrase of the scripture portion for today's message, which I read to you a few minutes ago. It's very important. But they were kept from recognizing him. It is a significant detail, absolutely essential, if we are to understand what unfolds now on the Emmaus Road. It's also full of meaning, which has many, many possibilities. They were kept from recognizing him. Some emphasize that the Lord caused them to have this restricted vision. Others say their own situation, their own doubt, their own confusion limited their perception capacity. And still others emphasize that we probably are looking at some combination of both of these factors. Well, the fact is, according to our text, Cleopas and his companion experienced what I've referred to in my notes as impeded vision. Even when this man Jesus, this very Jesus, who was the focus of all of their angst and their chagrin and their fear and their confusion, just when he literally came and walked by their side so close they could touch him, they still were unable to recognize him. Whatever the cause or combination of causes, their diminished visual capacity speaks volumes about their lives, their circumstances, and their condition at this very moment in their existence. So let's take a look at their impeded vision. What's their problem? First of all, I would call their problem yesterday eyes. Chapter 14. 24 rather, verse 14. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. It's evident that as they walked, they rehearsed, they relived, and yes, they debated all of the events of the last 3 days. I wonder where Cleopas and his companion, I wonder where their firsthand knowledge of events really begins. Were they somewhere in the background at Gethsemane and saw that and witnessed the betrayal? Were they at the trial? Did they visibly see the scourging, the mocking, the crown of thorns? Did they actually stand at the foot of the cross and see the crucifixion? What was hearsay in their knowledge bank of those 3 days, and how much did they eyewitness? It is evident from their conversation as we read Luke's words and their demeanor as Luke describes it that these were two absolutely devastated people when we meet them on the road to Emmaus. And as we find them there, it's very clear their feet are carrying them away from Jerusalem, but their heads and their hearts stayed behind, reliving, reviewing all of yesterday's pain through yesterday eyes. If only they could undo everything. If only they could some way turn back the clock and reverse time. If only they could rewind those moments, make everything like they were before all of this madness began. Everything would once again be fixed and fine, and they could move on with life. Some way, these people missed the critical teachings of Jesus. The Word tells us that multiple times Jesus explained to them exactly what was going to transpire. Matthew chapter 16 and verse 21 is one of those examples. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. How plainer can you be? And again in chapter 17, verse 22, the Son of Man, Jesus said, is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and on the third day he will be raised to life. And the disciples, when they heard that, were filled with grief. Instead of hearing his words as the explanation of a complete cycle of events which would end in incredible victory, phase one, betrayal, phase two, killed, phase three, raised to life again, they missed out on phase three. They were stymied by phase one and phase two, betrayal and death, and so they grieved. No wonder then that they are found here by us today lamenting the disruptive, the course-changing phase one and two while seemingly totally oblivious to phase three. As clearly as phase one and two, Jesus said a phase three will take place. They did not see the critical phase three. They could not see the defined process through to its victorious end. And so they seem left to a stint of longing and pining for things the way they were, longing for yesterday before all of this started, longing for yesterday through yesterday eyes. Rewind that crucified part. Rewind that betrayed part. all because of impeded vision and impeded understanding, keeping them from seeing that third part, resurrection. Jethro Tull, a British rock group of the 1960s, and this may be only the second time they've ever been referred to in a sermon. And the first one was at 9 o'clock. They recorded these words back in 1969. Oh, we won't give in, we'll keep living in the past. Oh, we won't give in, let's go, living in the past. Oh, no, we won't give in, let's go, living in the past. Yesterday eyes create that type of infatuation with yesterday's status quo. Yesterday is familiar. Yesterday is safe. Yesterday is very orderly. Let's go back to yesterday. The problem is, yesterday in your life was designed as a stepping stone to today and a stepping stone from today to tomorrow. We are intended to journey with God and His Son, who the Bible very carefully declares to be just the same yesterday and today and all of our tomorrows forever and ever. But when yesterday eyes take over, we begin defining everything in terms of yesterday. Just yesterday morning, no pun intended, I was sitting at a restaurant with a colleague having breakfast. And he shared with Deborah and I the most incredible story, talking about a town several hundred miles due south of here, a very prestigious church in that town, not a Pentecostal church at all, but a traditional denomination. This particular church has what many churches have in these days, what they define as their Orthodox service in the sanctuary with pipe organ and responsive readings and hymns from long ago and formality that their liturgy is accustomed to. And in some anteroom of the church, there is another group that meets at another hour. In this particular church, they are mostly 45 years of age and younger, and they worship a great deal like we do. You go in there and you will see their hands in the air as they sing. They sing the very same choruses that we sing. They have tears running down their eyes. It's all just about the same. They're not, however, a Pentecostal church to any degree whatsoever. They meet in the back. That's a very vibrant service. And the Orthodox service goes on upstairs with the pipe organ and all of those wonderful things that go with that denomination's formal liturgy. The pastor of that church had an experience recently that basically upset his apple cart completely. He was in bed at home, asleep, and he had a dream. And in that dream, some unusual things happened. He found himself walking into that contemporary service downstairs. And as he walked through that congregation, he saw them with their hands raised. He saw them with tears coming out of their eyes. He saw them singing that vibrant worship just like we have here. But there was an added element that day. Every one of them was speaking in tongues. And as he witnessed this happening, the Lord spoke to this denominational pastor and said to him, "If I chose for you to take this path and follow this path, would you be willing to do it?" And that pastor, in all honesty, responded, "Not quite, Lord. That's not what I was trained to do in seminary. That's not where my theology lies. I know nothing about that. That just ain't me, Lord," and went back to sleep and immediately had the dream a second time. The exact same dream. And as he walked through that congregation of 45s and under, they were all speaking in tongues. And the Lord again spoke to him and said, "If I were to tell you that it is my plan and my will for you to walk this path, would you be willing to walk this path?" Lord, the pastor says, I have already defined that for you. This is not a good fit. Can I sleep now? This is not the way I see life. This is not what I'm looking for. This is not what our denominational practice is. I'm sorry, Lord, you need to visit somebody else in the night hours. And immediately went back to sleep. And the third time, had the same dream. Walked through that congregation, and everyone in the room was speaking in tongues. And the third time, the Lord spoke to him and said, if I chose this path for you to walk, would you be willing to walk it in obedience to me? And the pastor's response to him was, Lord, you know. It sounds so biblical. Now, what's he going to do with that? What would you do with something like that in your life? What would anybody do with something like that? There are decisions to be made. This is not the way I know things. Can we just rewind this and go back to last week before I ate all of that chili and went to sleep? We just need to get out of this. It's not going to work. That's a choice. That's the choice that can be made. Or the choice can be made to recognize that this is the work of God and deal with it. And that is what this pastor chose to do. You're going to hate me because this is a story in process and hasn't been finished yet. But this pastor called my Assemblies of God friend and says, I have a sermon I'm going to preach next Sunday in my church, and I want you to be here to hear it. And my colleague went to that church and sat in that auditorium under that pipe organ and heard that pastor tell a congregation of 800 people in that prestigious church exactly what I have just told you. If you knew the church, you'd probably be wondering, are they getting ready to send him to another congregation, or are they not going to offer him one at all? The point I'm trying to make to you is this. We all come to our moments in life where something comes up that we really don't even sometimes want to go through. But unless we get so stuck in yesterday eyes that we forget that there is a God of yesterday, absolutely. But he is also the God of today, absolutely. And he also is the God of tomorrow, absolutely. And he always is at work in our life. Bring it on, God, and let's see what you have for us. The choice is ours. Yesterday eyes really don't permit that. The condition of yesterday, by the way, I'll tell you the rest of that story when I hear it. I know what I'm expecting, but I'm not going to put words in the Lord's mouth. The condition of yesterday eyes is very pervasive. Students, we have a lot of students at Central Assembly. Students at a very young age can learn about yesterday eyes. Leaving home for the first time, they can be thrown a huge curveball by discovering that the outside world, beyond the safety and security of the known and the familiar, is not always what they anticipated and can be a huge challenge. Roommates at college sometimes come from a completely different culture than ours. They may be from Arkansas or somewhere. And they also come with dirty socks sometimes. Maybe a new and bigger city, maybe professors with different styles or different perspectives. And there's that issue of finding a church to go to, and there never is one quite like home, is there? All of these can create a knee jerk that says, I don't need to deal with this. I want to go back to where I know how things are going to be. I want to go back to things that are comfortable and sure and solid. And so they get caught with yesterday eyes and sometimes bail. And do not see and recognize and experience what God has planned for them today. It is possible for you and me to have so many memories, such strong attachments to what God did yesterday, such a longing to see those things restored and recycled again, that if we're not careful, we can actually miss seeing what God is doing today because he's doing it different than before. I'm not speaking to any of you now on this next point. I'm only speaking to myself. I carry a huge concern that after all mine and Deborah's prayers for our children and our grandchildren and the younger members of our extended family, that they will know God's reality in their lives, I fear that I will miss seeing and knowing what God is doing in and through them, because their template for responding and applying the things of God is not an exact fit to mine. So I spend a lot of time listening and observing and trying to feel what is going on in the lives of my sons and daughter-in-law and grandchildren and extended relatives of the younger ages, so that I can know that there is spiritual life there. And as I do that, I find God dynamically present and active in new ways and true ways in today's generation, in ways that I deeply appreciate. In our own faith community, right here at Central, we have over 100 years of yesterdays in our history. We can use those years to draw from and reflect upon and receive strength from, but never think in focusing on our yesterdays that there is not also a glorious today and an even more glorious tomorrow if we keep our vision clear and our faith high and we avoid this problem of yesterday eyes. Then there's the issue of crucified hope. Cleopas spoke to Jesus before he recognized him and said this to him, explaining what was going on. Well, they crucified him. We had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And now he's gone. When he died, the world changed forever. The earth quaked. Tombs burst open. The veil of the temple was rent right down the middle, that which kept everyone out of the holiest place. Well, Cleopas and his companions and the others had not pieced together the scope and the impact of all of this yet. But they knew, or they thought they knew, that the events of those 3 days for them meant it was all over. It was finished. Jesus died at 3 p.m. His family was too poor and lived too far away to arrange his burial, so a rich stranger offered his own grave, and the body of Jesus was prepared and laid away in a borrowed tomb. And along with his body being laid away went their crucified hopes. Cleopas, like the others, had believed him, had loved him. This Jesus offered so much. They all saw so much promise, so much hope in him. He won their hearts. He had their allegiance. Most of all, they had hoped that he was the one who would be the Redeemer, Liberator of Israel. He would be the Messiah. He created for them hope, and all of it had been dashed in that 72-hour period on a cruel cross and now lying in a cold grave. John chapter 11 tells another story of hopes and dreams confronting death and death seemingly winning. Lazarus, a friend of Jesus and brother to Mary and Martha, was sick. In fact, he died. And when Jesus arrived 4 days later, they lamented, "If only you had been here." Well, in this second story, there was also a tomb. There was also a stone over the door. And there was also a body inside wrapped in grave clothes. Jesus came to the tomb and commanded that the rock be rolled away. Well, Lazarus had been in that grave for 4 days already, and as a consequence, decay had already begun. Jesus had already raised the daughter of Jairus with her body still lying in his home, her father's home. He had raised the widow's son as they carried that body from the home to the place of burial. However, there's not a recorded case of Jesus ever raising one whose body was already in the state of decay. So you see, the hopelessness of dead dreams, dead relationships, and dead hopes was palpable in that home in Bethany until Jesus got there. So at this point, chronologically, there were multiple testimonies of raised-to-life power in the ministry of Jesus. But this time they were talking about Jesus, not somebody else. And the crucifixion had just been too gruesome. The injury inflicted was beyond fixing. It was just over. Impeded vision and buried hope that day for Cleopas and his companion kept them from seeing anything. I told the Wednesday night crowd of a young couple in this church who just left us Matt and Shay were attending Central Assembly. They are, in fact, our niece and nephew. And Matt is a graphic artist who all of his life has wanted to be a graphic artist, cartoonist for the Walt Disney Corporation. Do that stuff. He was here as a graphic artist working for a company, and in the economic times of today, that company downsized by releasing one half of their entire staff, and Matt lost his job. A very responsible person, he came to see me a few days later with just hopelessness all over him. And he sat across a restaurant table from me, and I knew that he and his wife were in their first pregnancy waiting for their first baby, and tears streamed down his face as he said to me, "In all of this coming down around me and all my hopes being dashed so very suddenly, we have not even had one day where we could enjoy our very first pregnancy, not one day." And I wept with him and then tried to tell him, "Matt, it's never over till it's over. We got to trust God. We got to trust God." I knew that the following Sunday I was going to preach on the intersections of life. I also knew that Matt was going to be out of town. For some reason, Matt didn't go out of town. He was here. He came to the altar. He and Shay just wept profusely. He came over to me, and I just felt led to say, "Matt, it's going to be all right." And the very next day, events started falling into place that were absolutely incredible. It's too long a story for me to tell, but it wound up with him getting a surprise phone call from the Walt Disney Corporation asking him to be at work in Orlando, Florida, 1 week later. He's been there a week now. He called me yesterday. He says everything has fallen into place. The house we've got, it had to be from God, just like everything else. And this morning, Pastor Mike's wife, Daisy, her brother is the pastor of a church in Celebration, Florida, where they live, and they are worshiping in that church this morning. Listen, it's incredible that God has given Matt and Shay a job, but the more incredible thing is what he's teaching them about never give up on what you determined to be crucified hopes. There is the possibility of a resurrection. And if the loss of a job is a death knell, then following Jesus step by step every day is a simple reality of resurrection. And as far as I'm concerned, resurrection trumps death any day of the week. Just ask Matt and Shay. But Cleopas now on this dusty road, they still don't get it. Impeded vision from yesterday eyes and crucified hopes, and now they're dealing with transition trauma because it just gets worse and worse. What's more, they said, it's the third day since all of this took place, and some of the women have amazed us. They went to the tomb this morning but didn't find the body. And would you believe it? We sent some men out there to verify all of this, and they came back and said, it's true. How complicated can it get? An empty tomb, an angelic message, leadership verifying all of this. There were stories floating around, you see, that the body was missing from that tomb, or that he had indeed come back to life. Some of the women reported that it was empty, said there was an angelic messenger there saying that Jesus was indeed alive, and then the men went out there and came back and said, it is empty. Some would remember maybe that Jesus had predicted something like this, and others would reflect on his own miracles and figure, well, if anybody could pull this off, it would be Jesus. Well, for Cleopas and his companion, this was becoming the proverbial straw that, well, it was too much to hope. It was too far-fetched, too impossible. This transitioning from yesterday's reality or yesterday's status quo to some kind of new status quo, we're not making any progress here. Instead of getting clearer, it's just getting more befuddling by the moment. Hurry, straighten this thing out. And when we are in that transition period, that transition process, that usually is one of our issues. Let's hurry and get this over with. And yet in most transitions in our life, God has multiple things that he's trying to accomplish in our hearts and lives. It's too much for them to hope for, too far-fetched, too impossible, so overwhelming they just wanted it all to go away. They had believed. that Jesus was the Savior. They had joined his cause. They believed in him as being one sent by God. All their hopes were shattered when he was killed on that cross. And now all of this stuff, can't we just let him rest? They didn't want to get their hopes back up just to have disappointment one more time. Although he told them and prepared them, it was not in the template of their life, this thing called resurrection, so they couldn't even imagine it. It seems to me that the missing ingredient may just be found in the last phrase of verse 24. These verses are telling what had been found by the women and men who visited the tomb, yet there was one thing missing. You know that folded towel near where the body of Jesus had laid? That's intriguing. That empty tomb, that's very interesting. Those angelic messengers, that's more than interesting. But there's one thing missing. The word puts it this way. But him they did not see. The greatest proof of the resurrected Jesus would be Jesus. Now let's conclude by talking about the aha moment. We could talk about this from the perspective of education in a lot of different fields, but let me talk to you about it from the perspective of missions. Working with various people groups, we discover that every people group seems to have that aha moment when you've just discovered that you've learned something and you're stunned by it. And there usually is a cultural signal that goes along with that. Let me give you about three examples. I worked with one people group, and their aha moment signal was very, very subtle and very, very quiet. When suddenly revelation dawned on them that they became aware of something for the first time, they would dart their eyes back and forth and laugh. Just like they had a secret nobody else had, just like nobody else had ever learned it. I worked with another group that it wasn't quite so subtle. When they had their aha moment, it didn't matter what it was about, important or trivial, their aha moment signal was this. Aha! Everybody knew they had an aha moment. Then a third group that I worked with, theirs was just subtly different. Their aha moment signal was something like this. Oh! Everybody signals that aha moment just a little bit differently. Truth is, Cleopas and his companion, they're about to have an aha moment. When Jesus was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him. You see, they had talked him into remaining for the night. His conversation was so moving that they gave him special honor and asked him if he would do the honors of being host that night. Something that was not abnormal in that culture. And so it was he who took the bread and gave thanks and broke it and began to give it to them, and something clicked. Was it remembering one time when he did that as he took a few fish and a few loaves and broke the bread and gave thanks for it and distributed it to thousands of people? Was that the aha moment? Was it that they were familiar with that upper room experience where he went through the Passover for the last time and they remembered that and that was this aha moment? Or was it the fact that when he lifted his hands holding that bread, they saw fresh nail prints in those hands? And was that their aha moment? Whatever happened, whatever caused it, the breaking of bread broke the bonds of impeded vision and they saw him as the resurrected Jesus. No wonder their feet were light and fast when they made that lightning journey back to Jerusalem to tell the others. And they were there when Jesus entered the room where they were all assembled. And I would just say to you, what more appropriate way for the resurrected Son of God, full of authority and power and compassion and love, what better way for such a one to come into the house than just to walk straight through the walls without any need for a door? And there he was, the missing ingredient, the proof positive of the resurrection story. I love our reflective reading in the bulletin today. Timothy Keller, in The Reason for God, concludes this small segment with these words: "After the death of Jesus, the entire Christian community suddenly adopted a set of beliefs that were brand new, and until that point had been totally unthinkable. The first Christians had a resurrection-centered view of reality, a brand new status quo. Jesus is alive." Would you stand with me, please? And so today, whether God's people are in Jerusalem or Japan or China or Chile, whether they are in Bangladesh or Brazil or Ozark or Stratford, doesn't make any difference. The Redeemed Church of Jesus proclaims in front of skeptics, in front of critics, in front of unbelievers, in the face of intellect and in the face of ignorant, to those on the left and on the right, it's the same message that we proclaim in this new status quo. This man, Jesus, sent from God, he is alive. You ask me personally how that I know he's alive this morning. It is not from hearsay. It is not from research. It is not secondhand. It's not folklore. It's not theory. It's very simple, however. I know he's alive because he lives within my heart, and I sense him there every day. That may be simplistic. That may be too simple for you. It's just fine for me to know that Jesus, the living Son of God, lives and moves and has his presence in my heart and life and interacts with me every single day. I would say to you that the proclamation that he is alive is critical to our Christian faith. We ought to say it louder. We ought to say it more often. It is fundamental to who we are, and we need to celebrate it today. Jesus is alive. He is alive. You ask me how I know he's alive. He's here in this auditorium with us this morning. We're going to sing a song of celebration in just a moment. But before we do, I'm going to invite our pastoral staff and our church board and our other prayer workers to come and prepare to receive you as you come forward with your needs in prayer. Doesn't it stand to reason? Are you really believing what I'm telling you this morning, that Jesus is alive? And if he is alive and present among us, why in the world would any of us take a burden, a care, a concern, a fear, and walk out that door and carry it on? Why would we not bring it and lay it at his feet and see his miraculous power intervene and respond and become the answer to what we're searching for? We're going to sing, and as we do, I want to invite you to come and bring that need to the feet of Jesus. I promise you, he's here to respond to you and meet your need this very moment. Would you come?